decade to figure out is that the stage light beaming into our eyes hinders our concentration. This is how police interrogations of suspects used to be run. Beam a light on the suspect and wait for him to start singing. But in the thick of the lecture, speakers can't identify what is wrong, so they attribute the loss of concentration to simply being on the stage. So the practice continues. Why? Because those who lecture to large audiences don't work on lighting, and light engineers don't lecture to large audiences. Another small example of top-down progress. Metro North, the railroad between New York City and its northern suburbs, renovated its trains in a total overhaul. Trains look more modern, neater, have brighter colors, and even have such amenities as power plugs for your computer that nobody uses. But on the edge, by the wall, there used to be a flat ledge where one can put the morning cup of coffee. It is hard to read a book while holding a coffee cup. The designer, who either doesn't ride trains or rides trains but doesn't drink coffee while reading, thinking it is an aesthetic improvement, made the ledge slightly tilted so it is impossible to put the cup on it. This explains the more severe problems of landscaping and architecture. Architects today build to impress other architects, and we end up with strange, irreversible structures that do not satisfy the well-being of their residents. It takes time and a lot of progressive tinkering for that. Or some specialist sitting in the Ministry of Urban Planning who doesn't live in the community will produce the equivalent of the tilted ledge as an improvement, except at a much larger scale. Specialization, as I will keep insisting, comes with side effects, one of which is separating labor from the fruits of labor. Simplicity. Now, skin in the game brings simplicity, the disarming simplicity of things properly done. People who see complicated solutions do not have an incentive to implement simplified ones. As we saw, a bureaucratized system will increase in complication from the interventionism of people who sell complicated solutions because that's what their position and training invite them to do. Things designed by people without skin in the game tend to grow in complication before their final collapse. There is absolutely no benefit for someone in such a position to propose something simple. When you are rewarded for perception, not results, you need to show sophistication. Anyone who has submitted a scholarly paper to a journal knows that you usually raise the odds of acceptance by making it more complicated than necessary. Further, there are side effects for problems that grow non-linearly with such branching out complications. Worse, non-skin-in-the-game people don't get simplicity. I am dumb without skin in the game. Let us return to patemata matemata, learning through pain, and consider its reverse, learning through thrills and pleasure. People have two brains, one when there is skin in the game, one when there is none. Skin in the game can make boring things less boring. When you have skin in the game, dull things like checking the safety of the aircraft because you may be forced to be a passenger in it cease to be boring. If you are an investor in a company, doing ultra-boring things like reading the footnotes of a financial statement where the real information is to be found becomes, well, almost not boring. But there is an even more vital dimension. Many addicts who normally have a dull intellect and the mental nimbleness of a cauliflower or a foreign policy expert are capable of the most ingenious tricks to procure their drugs. When they undergo rehab, they are often told that should they spend half the mental energy trying to make money as they did procuring drugs, they are guaranteed to become millionaires, but to no avail. Without the addiction, their miraculous powers go away. It was like a magical potion that gave remarkable powers to those seeking it, but not those drinking it. A confession. When I don't have skin in the game, I am usually dumb. My knowledge of technical matters, such as risk and probability, did not initially come from books. It did not come from lofty philosophizing and scientific hunger. It did not even come from curiosity. It came from the thrills and hormonal flush one gets while taking risks in the markets. I never thought mathematics was something interesting to me until, when I was at Wharton, a friend told me about the financial options I described earlier and their generalization, complex derivatives. I immediately decided to make a career in them. It was a combination of financial trading and complicated probability. The field was new and uncharted. I knew in my guts there were mistakes in the theories that used the conventional bell curve and ignored the impact of the tails, extreme events. I knew in my guts that academics had not the slightest clue about the risks. So, to find errors in the estimation of these probabilistic securities, I had to study probability, which mysteriously and instantly became fun, even gripping. When there was risk on the line, suddenly a second brain in me manifested itself, and the probabilities of intricate sequences became suddenly effortless to analyze and map. When there is fire, you will run faster than in any competition. When you ski downhill, some movements become effortless. Then I became dumb again when there was no real action. Furthermore, as traders, the mathematics we used fit our problem like a glove, unlike academics with a theory looking for some application. In some cases, we had to invent models out of thin air and could not afford the wrong equations. Applying math to practical problems was another business altogether. It meant a deep understanding of the problem before writing the equations. But if you muster the strength to weightlift a car to save a child, above your current abilities, the strength gained will stay after things calm down. So, unlike the drug addict who loses his resourcefulness, what you learn from the intensity and the focus you had when under the influence of risk stays with you. You may lose the sharpness, but nobody can take away what you've learned. This is the principal reason I am now fighting the conventional educational system, made by dweebs for dweebs. Many kids would learn to love mathematics if they had some investment in it, and more crucially, they would build an instinct to spot its misapplications. Regulations versus legal systems. There are two ways to make citizens safe from large predators, say, big powerful corporations. The first one is to enact regulations, but these, aside from restricting individual freedoms, lead to another predation, this time by the state, its agents, and their cronies. More critically, people with good lawyers can game regulations, or, as we will see, make it known that they hire former regulators and overpay for them, which signals a prospective bribe to those currently in office. And, of course, regulations, once in, stay in. And even when they are proven absurd, politicians are afraid of repealing them under pressure from those benefiting from them. Given that regulations are additive, we soon end up tangled in complicated rules that choke enterprise. They also choke life. For there are always parasites benefiting from regulation, situations where the business person uses government to derive profits, often through protective regulations and franchises. The mechanism is called regulatory recapture, as it cancels the effect of what a regulation was meant to do. The other solution is to put skin in the game in transactions, in the form of legal liability and the possibility of an efficient lawsuit. The Anglo-Saxon world has traditionally had a predilection for the legal approach instead of the regulatory one. If you harm me, I can sue you. This has led to the very sophisticated, adaptive, and balanced common law, built bottom-up via trial and error. When people transact, they almost always prefer to agree, as part of the contract, on a Commonwealth, or formerly British-ruled, venue as a forum in the event of a dispute. Hong Kong and Singapore are the favorites in Asia, London and New York in the West. Common law is about the spirit, while regulation, owing to its rigidity, is all about the letter. If a big corporation pollutes your neighborhood, you can get together with your neighbors and sue the hell out of it. Some greedy lawyer will have the paperwork ready. The enemies of the corporation will be glad to help, and the potential costs of the settlement would be enough of a deterrent for the corporation to behave. This doesn't mean one should never regulate at all. Some systemic effects may require regulation, say, hidden tail risks of environmental ruins that show up too late. If you can't effectively sue, regulate. The Ralph Nader to whom I dedicate this book is the Ralph Nader who helped establish the legal mechanism to protect consumers and citizens from predators, less so the Ralph Nader who occasionally makes some calls to regulate. Now, even if regulations had a small net payoff for society, I would still prefer to be as free as possible, but assume my civil responsibility, face my fate, and pay the penalty if I harm others. This attitude is called deontic libertarianism. Deontic comes from duties. By regulating, you are robbing people of freedom. Some of us believe that freedom is one's first most essential good. This includes the freedom to make mistakes, those that harm only you. It is sacred to the point that it must never be traded against economic or other benefits. 4. Soul in the game. Finally and centrally, skin in the game is about honor as an existential commitment and risk-taking, a certain class of risks, as a separation between man and machine and, some may hate it, a ranking of humans. If you do not take risks for your opinion, you are nothing. And I will keep mentioning that I have no other definition of success than leading an honorable life. We intimated that it is dishonorable to let others die in your stead. Honor implies that there are some actions you would categorically never do, regardless of the material rewards. She accepts no Faustian bargain, would not sell her body for $500. It also means she wouldn't do it for $1 million, nor $1 billion, nor $1 trillion. And it is not just a via negativa stance. Honor means that there are things you would do unconditionally, regardless of the consequences. Consider duels, which have robbed us of the great Russian poet Pushkin, the French mathematician Galois, and of course many more at a young age, and in the case of Galois, a very young age. People incurred a significant probability of death just to save face. Living as a coward was simply no option, and death was vastly preferable, even if, as in the case of Galois, one invented a new and momentous branch of mathematics while still a teenager. There is actually an argument in favor of duels. They prevent conflicts from engaging broader sets of people, that is, wars, by confining the problem to those with direct skin in the game. As a Spartan mother tells her departing son, "With it or on it," meaning either return with your shield or don't come back alive. The custom was to carry the dead body flat on it. Only cowards throw away their shields to run faster. If you want to consider how modernity has destroyed some of the foundations of human values, contrast the above unconditionals with modernistic accommodations. People who, say, work for disgusting lobbies representing the interests of, say, Saudi Arabia in Washington, or knowingly play the usual unethical academic game, come to grips with their condition by producing arguments such as, "I have children to put through college." People who are not morally independent tend to fit ethics to their profession, with a minimum of spinning, rather than find a profession that fits their ethics. Now there is another dimension of honor, engaging in actions going beyond mere skin in the game to put oneself at risk for others, have your skin in other people's game. Sacrifice something significant for the sake of the collective. However, there are activities in which one is imbued with a sense of pride and honor without grand-scale sacrifice, artisanal ones. Artisans. Anything you do to optimize your work, cut some corners, or squeeze more efficiency out of it and out of your life will eventually make you dislike it. Artisans have their soul in the game. Primo, artisans do things for existential reasons first, financial and commercial ones later. Their decision-making is never fully financial, but it remains financial. Secundo, they have some type of art in their profession. They stay away from most aspects of industrialization. They combine art and business. Tertio, they put some soul in their work. They would not sell something defective or even of compromised quality because it hurts their pride. Finally, they have sacred taboos, things they would not do even if it markedly increased profitability. Compendiaria res improbitas, virtusque tarda. The villainous takes the short road, virtue the longer one. In other words, cutting corners is dishonest. Let me illustrate with my own profession. It is easy to see that a writer is effectively an artisan. Book sales are not the end motive, only a secondary target, even then. You preserve some sanctity of the product with strong prohibitions. For instance, in the early 2000s, the writer Faye Weldon was paid by the jewelry chain Bulgari to advertise their brand by weaving recommendations for their great products into the plot of her novel. A nightmare ensued. There was a generalized feeling of disgust on the part of the literary community. I also recall in the 1980s some people trying to give away books for free, but with advertisements in the midst of the text, as with magazines. The project failed. Nor do we industrialize writing. You would be disappointed if I hired a group of writers to help, as it would be more efficient. Some authors, such as Jerzy Kosinski, have tried to write books by subcontracting sections, leading to a complete ostracism after the discovery. Few of those writers cum contractors have seen their work survive. But there are exceptions, such as Alexandre Dumas-Pere, who was said to run a workshop of ghostwriters, 45, which allowed him to scale his production up to 150 novels, with the joke that he read some of his own books. But in general, output is not scalable, even if the sales of a book are. Dumas may be the exception that confirms the rule. Now, something very practical. One of the best pieces of advice I have ever received was the recommendation by a very successful and happy older entrepreneur, Yossi Vardi, to have no assistant. The mere presence of an assistant suspends your natural filtering, and its absence forces you to do only things you enjoy and progressively steer your life that way. By assistant here, I exclude someone hired for a specific task, such as grading papers, helping with accounting, or watering plants. Just some guardian angel overseeing all your activities. This is a via negativa approach. You want maximal free time, not maximal activity, and you can assess your own success according to such metric. Otherwise, you end up assisting your assistants or being forced to explain how to do things, which requires more mental effort than doing the thing itself. In fact, beyond my writing and research life, this has proved to be great financial advice, as I am freer, more nimble, and have a very high benchmark for doing something, while my peers have their days filled with unnecessary meetings and unnecessary correspondence. Having an assistant, except for the strictly necessary, removes your soul from the game. Think of the effect of using a handheld translator on your next trip to Mexico in place of acquiring a robust vocabulary in Spanish by contact with locals. Assistance moves you one step away from authenticity. Academics can be artisans. Even those economists who, misunderstanding Adam Smith, claim that humans are here to seek maximization of their income, express these ideas for free, and boast to not be into lowly commercial profit-seeking, not seeing the contradiction. A caveat with entrepreneurs. Entrepreneurs are heroes in our society. They fail for the rest of us. But owing to funding and current venture capital mechanisms, many people mistaken for entrepreneurs fail to have true skin in the game, in the sense that their aim is to either cash out by selling the company they helped create to someone else or go public by issuing shares in the stock market. The true value of the company, what it makes, and its long-term survival are of small relevance to them. This is a pure financing scheme, and we will exclude this class of people from our entrepreneur risk-taker class. This form of entrepreneurship is the equivalent of bringing great-looking and marketable children into the world with the sole aim of selling them at age 4. We can easily identify them by their ability to write a convincing business plan. Companies beyond the entrepreneur stage start to rot. One of the reasons corporations have the mortality of cancer patients is the assignment of time-defined duties. Once you change assignment, or better, company, you can now say about the deep Bob Rubin-style risks that emerge, "It's not my problem anymore." The same happens when you sell out, so remember that the skills at making things diverge from those at selling things. Arrogant will do. Products or companies that bear the owner's name convey very valuable messages. They are shouting that they have something to lose. Eponymy indicates both a commitment to the company and a confidence in the product. A friend of mine, Paul Wilmot, is often called an egomaniac for having his name on a mathematical finance technical journal, Wilmot, which at the time of writing is undoubtedly the best. Egomaniac is good for the product, but if you can't get egomaniac, arrogant will do. Citizenship des plaisances. Many well-to-do people who come to live in the United States avoid becoming citizens while living here indefinitely. They have a permanent residence permit as a free option, as it is a right, but not an obligation, for they can return it with a simple procedure. You ask them why they don't take the oath in front of a judge, then throw a cocktail party at a waterfront country club. The typical answer is taxes. Once you become a U.S. citizen, you will have to pay taxes on your worldwide income, even if you live overseas, and it is not easily reversible, so you lose the optionality. But other Western countries, such as France and the United Kingdom, allow their citizens considerable exemptions if they reside in some tax haven. This invites a collection of people to buy a citizenship via investments and minimum residence, get the passport, then go live somewhere tax-free. A country should not tolerate fair-weather friends. There is something offensive in having a nationality without skin in the game, just to travel and pass borders, without the downside that comes with the passport. My parents are French citizens, which would have made it easy for me to get naturalized a few decades ago. But it did not feel right. It even felt downright offensive. And unless I developed an emotional attachment to France via skin in the game, I couldn't. It would have felt fake to see my bearded face on a French passport. The only passport I would have considered is the Greek or Cypriot one, as I feel some deep ancestral and socio-cultural bond to the Hellenistic world. But I came to the U.S., embraced the place, and took the passport as commitment. It became my identity, good or bad, tax or no tax. Many people made fun of my decision, as most of my income comes from overseas, and if I took official residence in, say, Cyprus or Malta, I would be making many more dollars. If I wanted to lower taxes for myself, and I do, I am obligated to fight for it, for both myself and the collective, other taxpayers, and to not run away. Skin in the game. Heroes were not library rats. If you want to study classical values such as courage or learn about Stoicism, don't necessarily look for classicists. One is never a career academic without a reason. Read the texts themselves, Seneca, Caesar, or Marcus Aurelius, when possible. Or read commentators on the classics who were doers themselves, such as Montaigne. People who at some point had some skin in the game, then retired to write books. Avoid the intermediary when possible. Or forget about the texts, just engage in acts of courage. For studying courage in textbooks doesn't make you any more courageous than eating cow meat makes you bovine. By some mysterious mental mechanism, people fail to realize that the principal thing you can learn from a professor is how to be a professor. And the chief thing you can learn from, say, a life coach or inspirational speaker is how to become a life coach or inspirational speaker. So remember that the heroes of history were not classicists and library rats, those people who lived vicariously in their texts. They were people of deeds and had to be endowed with the spirit of risk-taking. To get into their psyches, you will need someone other than a career professor teaching Stoicism. My understanding of Seneca, as expressed in Antifragile, is all about asymmetry and optionality, both financial and emotional. As a risk-taker, I get something impossible to convey to classicists, which makes it frustrating to see accounts of him that miss the essential. They almost always don't get it. Actually, they never get it. In my experience, from a series of personal fights, many of these classicists, who know in intimate detail what people of courage such as Alexander, Cleopatra, Caesar, Hannibal, Julian, Leonidas, Zenobia ate for breakfast, can't produce a shade of intellectual valor. Is it that academia and journalism is fundamentally the refuge of the stochastophobe talker? That is, the voyeur who wants to watch but not take risks? It appears so. The most important chapter of the book, and conveniently the last one, The Logic of Risk-Taking, shows how some central elements of risks, while obvious to practitioners, can be missed by theoreticians for more than two centuries. Soul in the game, and some, not too much, protectionism. Let us now apply these ideas to modern times. Recall the story of the architects separated from the real users. This extends to more general systemic effects, such as protectionism and globalism. Seen that way, the rise of some protectionism may have a strong rationale, and an economic one. I leave aside the argument that globalization leads to a Tower of Babel-style cacophony, owing to the imbalance in the noise-signal ratio. The point here is that workers, people who do things, have each an artisan in them. For, contrary to what lobbyists paid by international large corporations are trying to make us believe, such protectionism does not even conflict with economic thinking, what is called neoclassical economics. It is not inconsistent with the mathematical axioms of economic decision-making, on which economics lays its foundations, to behave in a way that does not maximize one's narrowly defined dollar-denominated bottom line at the expense of other things. As I said earlier in the chapter, it is not irrational, according to economic theory, to leave money on the table because of your personal preference. The notion of incentives as limited to financial gain cannot otherwise explain the very existence of an economics academia that promotes the idea of self-interest. For a long time, some Swiss cantons, democratically, banned the sale of property to foreigners to prevent the disruptions from rich jet-setters without skin in the game in the place who come to bid up prices and hurt new young buyers permanently priced out of the market. Is this silly economically? Not at all, though some real estate developers would strongly disagree. We may be better off in a narrowly defined accounting sense, in the aggregate, by exporting jobs, but that's not what people may really want. I write because that's what I am designed to do, just as a knife cuts because that's what its mission is, Aristotle's arete, and subcontracting my research and writing to China or Tunisia would, perhaps, increase my productivity, but deprive me of my identity. So people might want to do things, just to do things, because they feel it is part of their identity. A shoemaker in Westchester County wants to be a shoemaker, to enjoy the fruits of his labor and the pride of seeing his merchandise in the stores, even if his so-called economic condition might benefit from letting a Chinese factory make the shoes and converting to another profession. Even if such a new system allows him to buy flat-screen TV sets, more cotton shirts, and cheaper bicycles, something is missing. It may be cruel to cheat people of their profession. People want to have their soul in the game. In that sense, decentralization and fragmentation, aside from stabilizing the system, improves people's connection to their labor. Skin in the ruling. Let us close with a historical anecdote. Some might well ask, law is great, but what would you do with a corrupt or incompetent judge? He could make mistakes with impunity. He could be the weak link. Not quite, or at least not historically. A friend once showed me a Dutch painting representing the judgment of Cambyses. The scene is from the story reported by Herodotus concerning the corrupt Persian judge Sisamnes. He was flayed alive on the order of King Cambyses as a punishment for violating the rules of justice. The scene of the painting is Sisamnes' son dispensing justice from his father's chair, upholstered with the flayed skin, as a reminder that justice comes with, literally, skin in the game. Prologue, Part 3. The Ribs of the Incerto. 7 pages per sitting, 7 pages annum is the perfect rate. Rereaders need re-reviewers. Now that we've outlined the main ideas, let us see how this discussion fits the rest of the Incerto project. Just as Eve came out of Adam's ribs, so does each book of the Incerto emerge from the penultimate one's ribs. The Black Swan was an occasional discussion in Fooled by Randomness. The concept of convexity to random events, the theme of Antifragile, was adumbrated in The Black Swan. And finally, Skin in the Game was a segment of Antifragile under the banner, Thou Shalt Not Become Antifragile at the Expense of Others. Simply, asymmetry in risk-bearing leads to imbalances and, potentially, to systemic ruin. The Bob Rubin trade connects to my business as a trader. As we saw, when these people make money, they keep the profits. When they lose, someone else bears the costs while they do their black swan invocation. Its manifestations are so ubiquitous that it has been the backbone of every book of the Incerto. Whenever there is a mismatch between a bonus period, yearly, and the statistical occurrence of a blow-up, every, say, 10 years, the agent has an incentive to play the Bob Rubin risk transfer game. Given the number of people trying to get on the money-making bus, there is a progressive accumulation of black swan risks in such systems. Then, boom, the systemic blow-up happens. The hidden risk transfer is not limited to bankers and corporations. Some segments of the population play it quite effectively. For instance, people who live in those coastal areas that are prone to hurricanes and floods are effectively subsidized by the state, hence taxpayers. Although they play victims on television after an event happens, they and the real estate developers are getting the benefits others pay for. The road. We will be guided by what is most lively. The ethics side is straightforward, as part of the general Fat Tony Isocrates asymmetry, and I have gone deeply into the matter thanks to a highly argumentative collaboration with the philosopher and walking companion, Constantine Sandys. Tort law is equally straightforward, and I had thought it would occupy a large section of this volume, but it will thankfully be minimal. Why? Tort law is insipid to those who don't have the temperament that takes one to law school. For, prompted by the fearless Ralph Nader, a coffee table in my study accumulated close to 20 volumes on contract law and torts. But I found the topic so dull that it was a Herculean task for me to read more than 7 lines per sitting, which is the reason God mercifully invented social media and Twitter fights. Unlike science and mathematics, law, while being very rigorous, doesn't offer surprises. Law cannot be playful. The mere sight of these books reminds me of a lunch with a former member of the Federal Reserve Board, the kind of thing to which one should never be subjected more than once per lifetime. So I will dispatch the topic of torts in a few lines. As we intimated in the first paragraphs of the introduction, some non-soporific topics, pagan theology, religious practices, complexity theory, ancient and medieval history, and of course probability and risk-taking, match this author's naturalistic filter. Simply, if you can't put your soul into something, give it up and leave that stuff to someone else. Talking about soul in the game, I had to overcome some shame as follows. In the Paris episode of Hammurabi at the Louvre, when I stood in front of the imposing basalt stele in the room with Koreans with selfie sticks, I felt uneasy not being able to read the stuff and having to rely on experts. What experts? This would have been fine if it was a cultural journey, but here I am professionally writing a book going very deep into that stuff. It felt like cheating not knowing the ancient text the way it was read and recited at the time. In addition, one of my episodic hobbies is Semitic philology, so I had no excuse. So I have been distracted by an obsession to learn enough Akkadian in order to recite Hammurabi's law with Semitic phonetics, sort of having some soul in the game. It may have delayed the completion of this book, but, at least when I mention Hammurabi, my conscience doesn't make me feel I am faking anything. An enhanced detector. This book came after a deep, non-academic, unplanned flirtation with mathematics. For after finishing Antifragile, I thought of retiring my pen for a while and settling into the comfortable life of a quarter university position, enjoying squid ink pasta in bon vivant company, lifting weights with my blue-collar friends, and playing bridge in the afternoon, the kind of tranquil, worry-free life of the 19th-century gentry. What I didn't forecast is that my dream of a tranquil life lasted only a few weeks, for I exhibited no skills whatsoever in retirement activities such as contract bridge, chess, lotto, visits to the pyramids in Mexico, etc. I once, by happenstance, tried to solve a mathematical brain teaser, and it led to 5 years of compulsive, time-invasive mathematical practice, with the obsessive bouts that plague people inhabited with problems. As usual with these things, I didn't do mathematics to solve a problem, just to satisfy a fixation. But I never expected the following effect. It made my BS detector so sensitive that listening to well-marketed nonsense by verbalistic people, especially academics, had the same effect as being put in a room with instances of randomly occurring piercing and jarring sounds, the type that kill animals. I am never bothered by normal people. It is the BSer in the intellectual profession who bothers me. Seeing the psychologist Steven Pinker making pronouncements about things intellectual has a similar effect to encountering a drive-in Burger King while hiking in the middle of a national park. It is under such an oversensitive BS detector that I have been writing this book. the book reviewers. And since we are talking about books, I close this introductory section with that one thing I've learned from my time in that business. Many book reviewers are intellectually honest and straightforward people, but the industry has a fundamental conflict with the public, even while appointing itself as representative of the general class of readers. For instance, when it comes to books written by risk-takers, the general public and some, but very few, book editors can detect what is interesting to them in a certain account, something those in the fake space of word production, in other words, non-doers, chronically fail to get. And they cannot understand what it is that they don't understand, because they are not really part of active and transactional life. Nor can book reviewers, by the very definition of their function, judge books that one rereads. For those familiar with the idea of nonlinear effects from Antifragile, learning is rooted in repetition and convexity, meaning that the reading of a single text twice is more profitable than reading two different things once, provided, of course, that said text has some depth of content. The convexity is implanted in Semitic vocabulary, Mishnah, which in Hebrew refers to the pre-Talmudic compilation of oral tradition, means doubling. Midrash itself may also be related to stamping and repeated grinding, and has a counterpart in the madrasa of the children of Ishmael. Books should be organized the way the reader reads or wants to read, and according to how deep the author wants to go into a topic, not to make life easy for the critics to write reviews. Book reviewers are bad middlemen. They are currently in the process of being disintermediated, just like taxi companies, what some call Uberized. How? There is, here again, a skin-in-the-game problem, a conflict of interest between professional reviewers who think they ought to decide how books should be written, and genuine readers who actually read books because they like to read books. For one, reviewers command an unchecked and arbitrary power over authors. Someone has to have read the book to notice that a reviewer is full of baloney. So, in the absence of skin in the game, reviewers such as Michiko Kakutani of the New York Times, now retired, or David Runciman, who writes for The Guardian, can go on forever without anyone knowing that they are either fabricating or drunk. Or, as I am certain, in the case of Kakutani, both. Book reviews are judged according to how plausible and well-written they are, never in how they map to the book. Unless, of course, the author makes them accountable for misrepresentations. It took close to 3 years for Fooled by Randomness to be understood as there is more luck than you think, rather than the message people were getting from reviews, it is all dumb luck. Most books don't survive 3 months. Now, almost 2 decades after the first installment of the Inserto, I have established ways to interact directly with you, the reader. Organization of the book. Book 1 was the introduction we just saw, with its 3 parts. Book 2, A First Look at Agency, is a deeper exposition of symmetry in agency and risk-sharing, bridging commercial conflict of interest with general ethics. It also introduces us briefly to the notion of scaling and the difference between individual and collective, hence the limitations of globalism and universalism. Book 3, That Greatest Asymmetry, is about the minority rule by which a small segment of the population inflicts its preferences on the general population. The short appendix for Book 3 shows 1. How a collection of units doesn't behave like a sum of units, but something with a mind of its own, and 2. The consequences of much of something called social science. Book 4, Wolves Among Dogs, deals with dependence and, let's call a spade, slavery in modern life. Why employees exist because they have much more to lose than contractors. It also shows how, even if you are independent and have FU money, you are vulnerable if people you care about can be targeted by evil corporations and groups. Book 5, Being Alive Means Taking Certain Risks, shows in Chapter 5 how risk-taking makes you look superficially less attractive, but vastly more convincing. It clarifies the difference between life as real life and life as imagined in an experience machine. How Jesus had to be man, not quite God, and how Donaldo won the election thanks to his imperfections. Chapter 6, The Intellectual Yet Idiot, presents the IYI who doesn't know that having skin in the game makes you understand the world, which includes bicycle riding, better than lectures. Chapter 7 explains the difference between inequality in risk and inequality in salary. You can be richer, but then you should be a real person and take some risk. It also presents a dynamic view of inequality as opposed to the IYI static one. The most egregious contributor to inequality is the condition of a high-ranking civil servant or tenured academic, not that of an entrepreneur. Chapter 8 explains the Lindy effect, that expert of experts who can tell us why plumbers are experts, but not clinical psychologists, why the New Yorker commentators on experts are not themselves experts. The Lindy effect separates things that gain from time from those that are destroyed by it. Book 6, Deeper into Agency, looks for consequential hidden asymmetries. Chapter 9 shows that, viewed from the standpoint of practice, the world is simpler and solid experts don't look like actors playing the part. The chapter presents BS detection heuristics. Chapter 10 shows how rich people are suckers who fall prey to people complicating their lifestyle to sell them something. Chapter 11 explains the difference between threats and real threats and shows how you can own an enemy by not killing him. Chapter 12 presents the agency problem of journalists. They will sacrifice truth and build a wrong narrative because of the necessity to please other journalists. Chapter 13 explains why virtue requires risk-taking, not the reputational risk reduction of playing white knight on the internet or writing a check to some non-governmental organization, NGO, who might help destroy the world. Chapter 14 explains the agency problem of people in geopolitics and historians who tend to report on wars rather than peace, leaving us with a deformed view of the past. History is also plagued with probabilistic confusions. If we got rid of peace experts, the world would be safer and many problems would be solved organically. Book 7, Religion, Belief, and Skin in the Game, explains creeds in terms of skin in the game and revealed preferences, how atheists are functionally indistinguishable from Christians, though not Salafi Muslims. Avoid the verbalistic. Religions are not quite religions. Some are philosophies. Others are just legal systems. Book 8, Risk and Rationality, has the two central chapters which I elected to leave for the end. There is no rigorous definition of rationality that is not related to skin in the game. It is all about actions, not verbs, thoughts, and talk. Chapter 19, The Logic of Risk-Taking, summarizes all my tenets about risk and exposes the errors concerning small probability events. It also classifies risks in layers, from the individual to the collective, and manages to prove that courage and prudence are not in contradiction, provided one is acting for the benefit of the collective. It explains ergodicity, which was left hanging. Finally, the chapter outlines what we call the precautionary principle. Appendix, Asymmetries in Life and Things. Table 2, Asymmetries in Society, where we left off in Antifragile. No skin in the game. Keeps upside, transfers downside to others, owns a hidden option at someone else's expense. Skin in the game. Keeps his own downside, takes his or her own risk. Skin in the game of others, or soul in the game. Takes the downside on behalf of others, or for universal values. No skin in the game. Bureaucrats, policy wonks. Skin in the game. Citizens. Soul in the game. Saints, knights, warriors, soldiers. No skin in the game. Consultants, sophists. Skin in the game. Merchants, businessmen. Soul in the game. Prophets, philosophers, in the pre-modern sense. No skin in the game. Large corporations with access to the state. Skin in the game. Artisans. Soul in the game. Artists, some artisans. No skin in the game. Corporate executives with suit. Skin in the game. Entrepreneurs. Soul in the game. Entrepreneurs, innovators. No skin in the game. Scientists who play the system, theoreticians, data miners, observational studies. Skin in the game, laboratory and field experimenters. Soul in the game, maverick scientists who take risks with conjecture at distance from common beliefs. No skin in the game, centralized government. Skin in the game, government of city-states. Soul in the game, municipal government. No skin in the game, copy editors. Skin in the game, writers, some editors. Soul in the game, real writers. No skin in the game, journalists who analyze and predict. Skin in the game, speculators. Soul in the game, journalists who take risks and expose frauds, powerful regimes, corporations, rebels. No skin in the game, politicians. Skin in the game, activists. Soul in the game, dissidents, revolutionaries. No skin in the game, bankers. Skin in the game, hedge fund traders. Soul in the game, they would not engage in vulgar commerce. No skin in the game, seeks awards, prizes, honors, ceremonies, medals, tea with the Queen of England, membership in academies, handshake with Obama. Soul in the game, highest, even only, award is death for one's ideas or positions. Socrates, Jesus, St. Catherine, Hypatia, Joan of Arc. Book 2. A First Look at Agency. Chapter 1. Why Each One Should Eat His Own Turtles. Equality in Uncertainty. Taste of Turtle. Where are the new customers? Sharia and asymmetry. There are the Swiss and other people. Rav Safra and the Swiss, but different Swiss. You who caught the turtles better eat them, goes the ancient adage. The origin of the expression is as follows. It was said that a group of fishermen caught a large number of turtles. After cooking them, they found out at the communal meal that these sea animals were much less edible than they thought. Not many members of the group were willing to eat them. But Mercury happened to be passing by. Mercury was the most multitasking sort of put-together god, as he was the boss of commerce, abundance, messengers, the underworld, as well as the patron of thieves and brigands, and, not surprisingly, luck. The group invited him to join them and offered him the turtles to eat. Detecting that he was only invited to relieve them of the unwanted food, he forced them all to eat the turtles, thus establishing the principle that you need to eat what you feed others. A customer is born every day. I have learned a lesson from my own naive experiences. Beware of the person who gives advice, telling you that a certain action on your part is good for you, while it is also good for him, while the harm to you doesn't directly affect him. Of course, such advice is usually unsolicited. The asymmetry is when said advice applies to you but not to him. He may be selling you something or trying to get you to marry his daughter or hire his son-in-law. Years ago, I received a letter from a lecture agent. His letter was clear. It had about 10 questions of the type, "Do you have the time to field requests? Can you handle the organization of the trip?" The gist of it was that a lecture agent would make my life better and make room for the pursuit of knowledge or whatever else I was about. A deeper understanding of gardening, stamp collections, Mediterranean genetics, or squid ink recipes. While the burden of the gritty would fall on someone else. And it wasn't any lecture agent. Only he could do all these things. He reads books and can get in the mind of intellectuals. At the time, I didn't feel insulted by being called an intellectual. As is typical with people who volunteer unsolicited advice, I smelled a rat. At no phase in the discussion did he refrain from letting me know that it was good for me. As a sucker, while I didn't buy into the argument, I ended up doing business with him, letting him handle a booking in the foreign country where he was based. Things went fine until 6 years later. I received a letter from the tax authorities of that country. I immediately contacted him to wonder if similar U.S. citizens he had hired incurred such tax conflict, or if he had heard of similar situations. His reply was immediate and curt. I am not your tax attorney, volunteering no information as to whether other U.S. customers who hired him because it was good for them encountered such a problem. Indeed, in the dozen or so cases I can pull from memory, it always turns out that what is presented as good for you is not really good for you, but certainly good for the other party. As a trader, you learn to identify and deal with upright people, those who inform you that they have something to sell, by explaining that the transaction arises for their own benefit, with such questions as, "Do you have an axe?" meaning an inquiry whether you have a certain interest. Avoid at all costs those who call you to tout a certain product disguised with advice. In fact, the story of the turtle is the archetype of the history of transactions between mortals. I worked once for a U.S. investment bank, one of the prestigious variety, called White Shoe because the partners were members of hard-to-join golf clubs for proto-aristocrats where they played the game wearing white footwear. As with all such firms, an image of ethics and professionalism was cultivated, emphasized, and protected. But the job of the salespeople, actually salesmen, on days when they wore black shoes was to unload inventory with which traders were stuffed, that is, securities they had in excess in their books and needed to get rid of to lower their risk profile. Selling to other dealers was out of the question, as professional traders, typically non-golfers, would smell excess inventory and cause the price to drop. So they needed to sell to some client on what is called the buy side. Some traders paid the sales force with percentage points, a variable compensation that increased with our eagerness to part with securities. Salesmen took clients out to dinner, bought them expensive wine, often ostensibly the highest on the menu, and got a huge return on the thousands of dollars of restaurant bills by unloading the unwanted stuff on them. One expert salesman candidly explained to me, "If I buy the client, someone working for the finance department of a municipality who buys his suits at some department store in New Jersey, a bottle of $2,000 wine, I own him for the next few months. I can get at least $100,000 profits out of him. Nothing in the market gives you such return." Salesmen hawked how a given security would be perfect for the client's portfolio, how they were certain it would rise in price, and how the client would suffer great regret if he missed such an opportunity, that type of discourse. Salespeople are experts in the art of psychological manipulation, making the client trade, often against his own interest, all the while being happy about it and loving them in their company. One of the top salesmen at the firm, a man with huge charisma who came to work in a chauffeured Rolls Royce, was once asked whether customers didn't get upset when they got the short end of the stick. "Rip them off, don't tick them off," was his answer. He also added, "Remember that every day a new customer is born." As the Romans were fully aware, one lauds merrily the merchandise to get rid of it. The price of corn in Rhodes. So, giving advice as a sales pitch is fundamentally unethical. Selling cannot be deemed advice. We can safely settle on that. You can give advice or you can sell by advertising the quality of the product, and the two need to be kept separate. But there is an associated problem in the course of the transactions. How much should the seller reveal to the buyer? The question, is it ethical to sell something to someone knowing the price will eventually drop, is an ancient one, but its solution is no less straightforward. The debate goes back to a disagreement between two Stoic philosophers, Diogenes of Babylon and his student Antipater of Tarsus, who took the higher moral ground on asymmetric information and seems to match the ethics endorsed by this author. Not a piece from both authors is extant, but we know quite a bit from secondary sources, or, in the case of Cicero, tertiary. The question was presented as follows, retailed by Cicero in De Officiis. Assume a man brought a large shipment of corn from Alexandria to Rhodes, at a time when corn was expensive in Rhodes because of shortage and famine. Suppose that he also knew that many boats had set sail from Alexandria on their way to Rhodes with similar merchandise. Does he have to inform the Rhodians? How can one act honorably or dishonorably in these circumstances? We traders had a straightforward answer. Again, stuffing. Selling quantities to people without informing them that there are large inventories waiting to be sold. An upright trader will not do that to other professional traders. It was a no-no. The penalty was ostracism. But it was sort of permissible to do it to the anonymous market and the faceless non-traders, or those we called the Swiss, some random suckers far away. There were people with whom we had a relational rapport, others with whom we had a transactional one. The two were separated by an ethical wall, much like the case with domestic animals that cannot be harmed, while rules on cruelty are lifted when it comes to cockroaches. Diogenes held that the seller ought to disclose as much as civil law requires. As for Antipater, he believed that everything ought to be disclosed, beyond the law, so that there was nothing that the seller knew that the buyer didn't know. Clearly, Antipater's position is more robust, robust being invariant to time, place, situation, and color of the eyes of the participants. Take for now that the ethical is always more robust than the legal. Over time, it is the legal that should converge to the ethical, never the reverse. Hence, laws come and go, ethics stay. For the notion of law is ambiguous and highly jurisdiction-dependent. In the U.S., civil law, thanks to consumer advocates and similar movements, integrates such disclosures, while other countries have different laws. This is particularly visible with securities laws, as there are front-running regulations and those concerning insider information that make such disclosure mandatory in the U.S., though this wasn't so for a long time in Europe. Indeed, much of the work of investment banks in my day was to play on regulations, find loopholes in the laws. And, counterintuitively, the more regulations, the easier it was to make money. Equality in uncertainty. Which brings us to asymmetry, the core concept behind skin in the game. The question becomes, to what extent can people in a transaction have an informational differential between them? The ancient Mediterranean and, to some extent, the modern world seem to have converged to Antipater's position. While we have buyer beware, caveat emptor, in the Anglo-Saxon West, the idea is rather new and never general, often mitigated by lemon laws. A lemon was originally a chronically defective car, say my convertible Mini, in love with the garage, now generalized to apply to anything that moves. So, to the question voiced by Cicero in the debate between the two ancient Stoics, if a man knowingly offers for sale wine that is spoiling, ought he to tell his customers? The world is getting closer to the position of transparency, not necessarily via regulations, as much as thanks to tort laws, and one's ability to sue for harm in the event a seller deceives him or her. Recall that tort laws put some of the seller's skin back into the game, which is why they are reviled, hated by corporations. But tort laws have side effects. They should only be used in a non-naive way, that is, in a way that cannot be gamed. As we will see in the discussion of the visit to the doctor, they will be gamed. Sharia, in particular the law regulating Islamic transactions and finance, is of interest to us insofar as it preserves some of the lost Mediterranean and Babylonian methods and practices, not to prop up the ego of Saudi princes. It exists at the intersection of Greco-Roman law, as reflected from people in Semitic territories' contact with the school of law of Berytus, Phoenician trading rules, Babylonian legislations, and Arab tribal commercial customs, and, as such, it provides a repository of ancient Mediterranean and Semitic lore. I hence view Sharia as a museum of the history of ideas on symmetry and transactions. Sharia establishes the interdict of Gerar, drastic enough to be totally banned in any form of transaction. It is an extremely sophisticated term in decision theory that does not exist in English. It means both uncertainty and deception. My personal take is that it means something beyond informational asymmetry between agents, inequality of uncertainty. Simply, as the aim is for both parties in a transaction to have the same uncertainty facing random outcomes, an asymmetry becomes equivalent to theft. Or, more robustly, No person in a transaction should have certainty about the outcome while the other one has uncertainty. Gerar, like every legalistic construct, will have its flaws. It remains weaker than Antipater's approach. If only one party in a transaction